Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, this meeting of the Housing Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Houseman?
Present.
Howard?
Present.
Tice? Tice? McBadgett?
Present.
Bliss?
Present.
Gomez? Gomez? Hassan? Hassan? Heinrich?
Heinrich, present.
Herr?
Present.
Juergens?
Juergens, present.
Olson?
Present.
Farr?
Present.
Ryer?
Present.
Let's go back through. Tice?
Present.
Thank you. Gomez? And then Hassan? All right, Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Wilcox. Members, today we're reviewing the Housing, Finance, and Policy Bill. This is an informational-only meeting, so no official action will take place. And before we begin, I just want to say that we are a divided legislature, the only one in the country. And I would write a different bill than the one you have before you. This is a negotiated agreement between the House and the Senate. A number of you have continued to make suggestions in the last few days, and I would write in those corrections and suggestions. The dilemma is any change we make to this bill would need the approval of the other body as well. And so that is the issue before us, that not a perfect bill, but a negotiated bill between the House and the Senate. We're going to begin with a walkthrough of the spreadsheet of the bill and then the language, and then open to members' questions. So we will begin with a walkthrough of the spreadsheet of the bill from Mr. Savory. Please, Mr. Savory, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the tape, Ken Savory, House Fiscal Staff. I'm going to go through the spreadsheet that was included by Mr. Worth and members in the email and in members' virtual packets. I'll start off with just kind of laying out some of the columns on the spreadsheet. The columns that represent House File 4 and then conversely Senate File 16 are located with atop the top of S, column T, column U, column V, and column W. I'll start first just kind of walking through the change items that were in House File 4 and Senate File 16. Starting on line 33, which is a $2,800,000 first year increase to the Housing Challenge Program. On line 34 is a $1 million increase to the Homeownership Assistance Fund. Skipping down a few lines, the next change item, which is line 36, the Workforce Homeownership Program, which is a $3,250,000 increase in FY22-23. And then on line 37 is an increase to the Manufactured Home Park Infrastructure Grants. That's $1,750,000 in FY22-23. And skipping down a few more lines, you'll see on line 42, which is $1 million increase to the Local Housing Trust Fund. And then on line 45, you'll see a $200,000 establishment of the Shelter Provider Task Force. That was a House position. And then on line 48, you'll see a carve out for $70,000 each fiscal year of the open access voicemail. And that is a carve out of the capacity building grants program. And that was a Senate position, which the Senate took in the conference. And so you'll see on line 50, the total amount of change items within House File 4 is $10 million in FY22. And then $0 in FY23 for a total of $10 million above base in FY22-23. And $10 million was the was the target for housing finance this year. Moving down the spreadsheet, you'll see on line 52, these are the total appropriations for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. You'll see $67,798,000 in FY22, and then $57,798,000 in FY23. And then on line 54, this bill also includes, House File 4 also includes $100 million of housing infrastructure bonds. And to pay the debt service, there is a debt service being tracked in this spreadsheet by Minnesota Management and Budget. So on line 54, you'll see in the FY24 and 25 columns, $4 million in FY24, and then $8 million in FY25 for a total of $12 million of debt service in the tails for the $100 million of housing infrastructure bonds. So all in total on line 59 for the bill, this is the total net general fund impact. You'll see the same numbers that I referred to for Minnesota Housing Finance Agency in FY22-23, but you'll see a slightly different number in FY24-25 in terms of the overall impact of the bill. So $61,798,000 in FY24 and $65,798,000 in FY25. So $12 million above the base in FY24-25. Moving down the spreadsheet a little bit more, there's a handful of other items. Members will recall the House heard a bill regarding the housing pool return application deposit, and that was just affecting revenues to the special revenue fund, and then conversely to the housing fund. And so that's on line 65, so $253,000 there, and then on line 68, $253,000 of less revenue for the housing development fund. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, you'll see kind of a little breakout of the housing infrastructure bonds allocation. Line 73 notes that there's $100 million of housing infrastructure bonds. And then line 74 notes that of that $100 million, $18,333,000 is for single family homes. And then on line 76, $15 million of the $100 million is for manufactured home park acquisition infrastructure. So total for sub-allocations of the $100 million of bonds is on line 78, and that's a third of that, a third of the $100 million, so $33,333,000. And then line 80 notes the remaining unallocated housing infrastructure bond balance. So remaining unallocated is $66,667,000. And Madam Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of the spreadsheet. We can pause here for questions or turn to Ms. Mellon or Ms. Griffin.
Madam Chair, you are muted right now.
Thanks for that reminder. I tend not to mute myself, so just thank you, Mr. Savory, for your walkthrough and your help and guidance while we put this bill together. We are so grateful to our staff who help at every step. Do we have clarifying questions from members for Mr. Savory? I don't see any hands. Mr. Worth, if I'm missing any, I don't see any hands. So thank you very much. We will now move on to an overview of the bill language for Ms. Griffin and Ms. Mullen. And I believe we start with Ms. Griffin, is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair. For the record, everyone, my name is Chelsea Griffin and I'm with House Research. So I'll be starting the overview of the bill language, beginning with Article 2, since Mr. Savory did such a fine job going over the appropriations that are in Article 1. Article 2, if you're following along with the bill, or with the delete everything amendment, it starts on page 8, and the document you should be looking at is coded A21-0225. So Article 2, Section 1 adds federally recognized American Indian tribes and tribal housing corporations to the entities to whom grants for affordable housing may be made in a natural disaster area. Section 2 removes the requirement that a service dog must have identification from a recognized school for service animals. Section 3 eliminates language referencing family income requirements for purposes of community land trust in a property tax statute and inserts a cross-reference to the appropriate income criteria and statute. Section 4 specifies that window fall prevention devices are not required in one and two family dwellings and townhouses when windows meet certain criteria. Section 5 clarifies that a service animal does not have to wear a physical identification about its training, and that it can be determined that it's an unfair discriminatory practice for the owner of housing to deny a person with a disability the use of a service animal, even when the physical identification is not present. Section 6 eliminates the limitation on rehabilitation loans that prohibits such a loan to be made in an amount that would exceed 110% of a property's market value. Section 7 authorizes the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, which I'll refer to as MHFA, to make rehabilitation loans for the purpose of replacement of manufactured homes. And this section also increases the maximum loan amount to $37,500. Section 8 authorizes MHFA to provide support to increase the capacity of entities to meet affordable housing needs. Section 9 clarifies the income limitation under the definition of persons and families of low and moderate income for purposes of community land trust. Section 10 is a new codified statute for support or service and support animal documentation. The subdivision 2 of this section allows a landlord to request supporting documentation for a licensed professional verifying the disability when a tenant makes a reasonable accommodation request for a service or support animal. Subdivision 3 provides that a landlord cannot charge additional fees or rent for a service or support animal, and the tenant is required to pay for any damages caused by the animal. Subdivision 4 provides that it's illegal to misrepresent that an animal is a service or support animal if it's not, and it's illegal to provide fraudulent documents to that effect. And Subdivision 5 provides that a landlord may deny a tenant's rental application or not approve the accommodation for a service or support animal if they violate the provisions of this section. It further clarifies that a landlord can still evict a tenant for a breach of lease. And Section 11 prohibits a tenant from being charged more than the prorated amount of rent for the last month of rent if the lease requires the tenant to move out before the last day of the month. With that, Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2. I'll pause for any questions.
Do we have questions for Ms. Griffin? I don't see any hands.
Okay, I'll turn it over to Ms. Mullen for Article 3.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, this is Mary Mullen from the House Research Department. I'm going to walk through Article 3, which is the manufactured homes article. This article amends the process for affixing a manufactured home park to real property and allows a manufactured home park to be affixed to property when the home is in a cooperative-owned park, which is a new section. So Section 1 provides a process to affix a manufactured home to real property when the park is owned by a nonprofit cooperative. The process here mirrors the existing process for affixing a home to real property. And then Section 2 rewrites the existing law on affixing a manufactured home park as an improvement to real property. Section 3 makes clarifying changes related to affixing a manufactured home to real property. Section 4 directs the reviser to update the statutory citations for the new section. And then Section 5 repeals the old process for the affixing a manufactured home park to a real property. And I will turn it back over to Chelsea for Article 4.
Ms. Scriven?
Okay, Article 4. So if you're following along in the DE amendment, this is on page 25. Section 1 authorizes the issuance of $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds. As Mr. Savory had noted in the spreadsheet, $18,333,000 of those HIBs must be applied to finance various costs related to single family housing, and $15 million must be applied for acquisition of manufactured home parks and for manufactured home park improvements and infrastructure. If MHFA has not committed the full amount of those allocations for single family housing and manufactured home parks by January 16th of 2024, the allocated amount may be applied to the other purposes for which housing infrastructure bonds can be issued. Section 2 provides for the debt service on the $100 million of housing infrastructure bonds. Section 3 clarifies that any fees collected by Minnesota Management and Budget under the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act may be deposited, or it must be deposited in a separate account in the Special Revenue Fund. Section 4 requires Minnesota Management and Budget to refund application deposit money to issuers that returned all of their bonding authority allocation from the 2020 housing pool to avoid a double bond fee due to the circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Section 5, it requires the $100 million of housing infrastructure bonds to be reduced by the amount of any federal funds that could come from a federal infrastructure bill enacted between June 1st of 2021 and the end of this year for loans and grants for the same purposes for which housing infrastructure bonds may be issued. And MHFA is required to report to the legislature by January 15th of 2022 as to the amount of any such reductions that may take place. And I'll turn Article 5 over to Ms. Mullen.
Ms. Mullen.
Will end the governor's orders and prevents evictions and lease terminations similar to what was in the governor's peacetime orders, but in a kind of a different fashion. Section 1 ends the executive order issued the governor during COVID-19 peacetime emergencies related to housing, includes the eviction moratorium that has been in place and related orders on the non-renewal and termination of leases. Section 2 is the main portion of this article, and it prohibits a landlord from terminating or failing to renew a lease for 105 days after this is enacted, except in cases where a tenant is endangering others, engaging in criminal activities, material violations of the lease, or when the tenant has requested the termination of the lease. These are similar to what's currently in the governor's executive orders. This provision also has an exception that allows the landlord to terminate or not renew a lease for 45 days after enactment if the tenant has failed to pay rent and is not eligible for the COVID-19 rental assistance program. This section also prohibits the landlord from filing an eviction for 100 days after enactment, except where the tenant endangers others, damage to property, or engaging in certain criminal activities. But it does allow evictions 15 days after enactment for situations where the tenant materially violated the lease. And there's an exception there that allows the landlord to file an eviction 75 days after enactment if the tenant has failed to pay rent and is not eligible for the COVID-19 emergency rental assistance. And if a tenant does not pay rent and refuses to apply for the COVID-19 rental assistance or cooperate in completing the application, then a landlord can proceed with the eviction. It also prohibits the termination of rental agreements, delivery of default notices, and filing of an eviction action on a tenant in a manufactured home park, except for the similar exceptions to the lease renewal and eviction for residential rental units, such as substantial damage to property or failing to comply with state and local laws. The phase out does last for 105 days, except as otherwise noted. So there are a few exceptions to that. There's also an extension, which is that if which is in section 4, which is that if a person has applied for the COVID-19 emergency rental assistance funding and they're waiting for that funding, then they cannot be evicted until June 1, 2022, as long as they're waiting for the funding to come through. Section 3 requires a landlord to provide a notice to a tenant 15 days before filing an eviction if the eviction is for non-payment of rent during the 105 days that this article would be enacted. The notice has to inform the tenant that the governor's eviction moratorium ended, that they're that they could be subject to an eviction. They have to tell the tenant how much the tenant owes and where the tenant can get information on rental assistance. A court can stay an eviction if the notice has not been provided. And then section 4 is that piece I was referring to, where if there's a rental application, a rental assistance application pending, which would cover the person's rent for non-payment, then they can't proceed with an eviction until after that application is processed and the funds have been distributed. And that lasts until June 1st, 2022. And that is all of Article 5. Ms. Griffin will do Article 6.
Ms. Griffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I'll conclude the overview of the DE amendment with Article 6. So if you're following along on the amendment itself, this starts on page 31. And there's only one section here to describe it's the task force on shelter. So this section establishes a task force on shelter, which will examine shelter policies and practices. And it requires a report to the legislature on the task force's specified findings and recommendations. Madam Chair, that concludes the overview of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Griffin and Ms. Mullen, for your counsel while we work to put this bill together. We are grateful to staff to get us to this point. Members, I should acknowledge that when we were still in the regular session, we had an appointment of Representative Agbaje, Representative Ryer, Representative Howard, and Representative Tice to a conference committee. We actually did have two public conference committees where we did the comparison of the House and Senate bill and had significant testimony about the bill at that time. And then we adopted a number of same and similar issues, which you see in this particular bill. Members will remember that we spent a significant amount of time on some tenant protection bills that we heard and passed and moved on. Unfortunately, that's the piece of the bill that that we have not moved forward on. Senator Duckworth actually suggested that maybe we have a work group in the interim that revisits some of that. And so I think I'll take that suggestion. And I know we'll have committee members who'll be interested in helping with that. So do we have questions from members for Ms. Griffin and Ms. Mullen about the language? I don't see any hands. Any comments or questions? Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who this question is directed to, but probably to you. Is the eviction moratorium language that is contained in this bill, the governor was part of the negotiations, I'm assuming, or somebody from his staff. So is this sufficient to be considered an off-ramp for the eviction moratorium? One of the prerequisites that he's talked about for ending his emergency powers. I know you can't answer that side of the question about his emergency powers, but was this designed with that in mind?
And I would invite Representative Howard to come into the conversation too, if you'd like. Yes, this is considered the off-ramp for the eviction moratorium. That's how we're categorizing it. We actually were able to resolve all of our issues between House and Senate, so we didn't have to move to leadership to have them resolve any of the issues. Representative Howard, any additional comments you'd like to make?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And specific to Representative Juergens' point, the first article in the off-ramp eliminates the governor's executive order on the eviction moratorium off-ramp and his subsequent executive orders. So in statute, it meets, I think, what some folks in the legislature on both sides of the aisle have been asking for us to do, which is come together with a legislative solution, which is what the governor is requesting of us as well.
Any follow-up, Representative Juergens?
No follow-up. Thank you both.
Mm-hmm. I don't see any other hands. That's Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not starting my video, what the heck? it's been one of those mornings. And my allergies are bad, so if I have to stop to sneeze or cough, please bear with me. I just have some concerns with some of the language that deals with the landlords and the notification, especially with the letter. I just feel like so many people know already what they're doing. And I've had numerous emails from housing providers that are explaining just a brief glimpse of what they're going through. And I have a colleague in the St. Cloud Sartell area who has three tenants alone who, he's not getting about, it's over $5,000 a month that he's missing out, but totally he's about 40,000 into this. And that's just three out of many. most of them know, some of them have health issues, which he is willing to deal with and has been doing it, but he isn't really finding much in getting some assistance for that person. He's had cancer and another issue and hasn't been able to work, but he is working with him and he still has a place to live. But do we really have anything that helps folks who have run into some of these medical issues? And then, and maybe because of the amount he makes, he's not qualifying, but he also has one who just isn't paying and refuses to apply for help. And I know that they can be evicted, but I wish we would have had something like this in place before, you know, we saw these egregious amounts that these landowners are having to, housing providers are having to deal with. And the other one is a woman who can certainly afford it. She gave him all his stubs. She's the CEO of a company and she hasn't paid anything. Do we have anything special that would deal with a couple of these situations? To me, they're a little bit different than some of the other things we're talking about. And I know he would be able to evict the one person who certainly can pay for it. But is there a way for them to get those monies back?
You know, I am wondering if we have the department is either Ryan Baumtrag or I'm not sure who we have from the department. Mr. Owen, do you know? Mr. Worth? We have anyone from the department?
Yes, Madam Chair. We do have Assistant Commissioner Baumtrag on the call as well.
Mr. Baumtrag, would you want to respond to that? Did you hear?
Yes, I did. Morning, Chair Hausman, Representative Tice for the record. I'm Ryan Baumtrag, Assistant Commissioner for Policy at Minnesota Housing. And Representative Tice, just to make sure we can walk through the details, I'll reach out to you to talk about the specifics in a couple of the cases that it sounds like you're walking through. There's somebody that might be over income, which would create a challenge that's set by federal law that we can't work with. But there might be other assistance that could help. There's also local recovery funds that might be available. So we can take that one offline. You mentioned another situation where somebody isn't paying and refusing to apply. In that case, that's covered in the evictions article where they would be able to be evicted. And then I think another situation with the health situation where somebody is struggling to apply, there are field partners and other resources that we could maybe put them in touch with to help them walk through the process. So we can look into who may be able to help kind of on the ground apply for the program.
Follow up, Representative
Tice. Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be very helpful. You know, he's the gentleman who is the housing provider is such a, I can't say enough how wonderful he is. He's just a great young man and really hurting. And I know we've had a couple instances with R5 where something's happened, they've lost jobs and things, and we've just been holding on to them. And it seems like things really work out. But with somebody who is ill, we've had a few like that, but it's really, really hard because you want to help them. But I don't know that we talk enough about some of the resources that are available for that. But I think, too, for a lot of folks, the extra time for notice and such, I think most folks are in tune to what the expectation is and what the law is. Most, in my experience, is most renters know what the law is, and they keep abreast of it, and they know when things change, and they know what's expected. And I would say that, you know, most landlords are keeping up with notice of right along, this is how much you're owing. And so that still is a very big concern for me. I think that's just putting another 2 weeks onto an open wound, which I'm seeing so many are emailing and saying what their situations are. And it's really worrisome to me. I wish we could have not done that. I mean, I get it, but I think it's been so long. And folks have been working with, and some tenants are just refusing to apply. So it's not like they don't know about it. And I look to it in that, you know, Rent Help Men does have folks working with them on the marketing side, that there should be enough information out there now, especially when we're getting closer to finding an off-ramp and some of the legislation we're doing. That's just very concerning for me. I don't like the direction that that's going. And
Representative Tice, I could also ask Ms. Mullen if she has anything further to add to your question. Ms. Mullen, do you have any particular extra information relative to?
Chair and members, I believe what Representative Tice was talking about was collecting past owed rent, which can be problematic, except that in some of the instances she described, it does sound like the tenants would have income. And if you do have income, you can sue and get a judgment in conciliation court and then collect either from the person or garnish their wages.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen. Any further follow-up, Representative Tice?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I'm aware of that, and I know folks are already talking about conciliation court and doing some things already before the amounts get too egregious. But it just is very disappointing that we know of somebody who absolutely can't pay and they just refuse to do it. Granted, she'll get evicted and it'll go on her record, but you know, it's just sad that people will let that happen. That's all I got for now. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any other hands up right now. Mr. Worth, am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, there are no other hands.
Okay, so I thank you all. That concludes the agenda for this morning. Thank you for the discussion on the bill. Big thank you to all of the nonpartisan staff in the House and the Senate, the agency staff, Chair Graheim, the House and Senate Working Group members for all of their work this year in helping to put this bill together. I have lots of disappointments when we get to this point. There would have been other things I would have liked to accomplish that we didn't, and we'll work at it again for next year. But the next meeting of the Housing Committee will be at the call of the chair. Thank you all, and we are adjourned.